What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
They're decolonizing it. Decolonizing. So they're taking out an entire swipe of history that happened. Captain Cook's replica of his boat is gone. And we're not allowed to see that because somehow we're ashamed of it. Maybe we should never be ashamed. It's history. Learn from it.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Jim Shockey. You, I'm sure, if you don't know the name, you've definitely seen him around, especially if you're in Canada. But, you know, Uncharted is pretty popular. Tell me about some of the stuff you got going on right now so our audience can press the pause button and go look you up.
Well, let's see. My wife passed away 10 days ago, so they're going to see a lot of that.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
9 years. There's my novel that I've been working on since I was 10 years old is release date in about a week. So the book tour starts. Our museum, our Handyman Museum here in Vancouver Island, you know, we'll hit 30,000 visitors for pretty quick this week and for the last year. And I'm trying to find a dog walker for my dog. So there's that's what I've got going on in my life.
What kind of dog is it?
It's a rescue dog from, well, basically from a bison ranch up in northern BC. So it's, the mother was 100% Caucasian shepherd, a big giant shed bear of a dog, and the father was Catahoula leopard dog.
Oh, wow. That's a mix. How big is it?
I weighed her. I took her into the vets when she was 1 year and 1 day old here last month, and she weighed 107.5 pounds.
All right. So, well,
she's still got to fill in. She's not going to be a ballerina.
Yeah, certainly. That's another year of growth. So we've got some Canadian listeners, but for the audience, you were born in Saskatchewan. Tell me about what it's like there, because I've heard things like Saskatchewan's the Texas of Canada.
It's more it would be more like the high Arctic of Alaska.
Okay.
It's cold, flat prairie land, short grass prairie, you know, Sioux, First Nations, Cree in the north, good family values. If you're from Saskatchewan, you know, work ethic. For my opening territories in the Yukon, I've got about 7.5 million acres, contiguous acres, that there's not a single road or not a house other than our cabins in it. And if we're looking for guides, Saskatchewan men and women are the ones we really appreciate if we can get our hands on them. They're good work ethic.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know much about that that area except for what I've heard. Now you've lived a pretty interesting life. A swimmer and water polo. I got a buddy that was a water polo at University of Texas, Austin, back in the day. Mm-hmm. It looks so exhausting. I don't know that I would be able to do it, to be honest. I mean, you're like in constant motion for a very long time.
Yeah, the water polo players were voted best bodies, you know, for the men on the men's side in the Olympics for, I think, at least two or three Olympics. I think they used Schroeder. His body was the model for the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics, the big nudes in front of the stadium, they picked a water polo body. It's every single muscle in your body you're using. So you not only have to have the cardio like a swimmer, but you've also got to have you're using your muscles. I mean, it's a strong, powerful sport. It's also, you know, akin to hockey in some ways, just because it's physical, and the intimidation is a big part of water polo. It's a great, I loved it. I was an all-American swimmer as well, but water polo, that was fun. I played at the World Aquatic Championships in Berlin in 78 and Ecuador in 1982, but we boycotted the 80 Olympics. In 84, Los Angeles, I didn't want to centralize with the team and train. I was getting married, so.
Sure.
It's a great sport, not for everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, how did you get into that instead of hockey or, you know, any of the other sports? What was it about swimming that drew you in?
You know, my mom didn't want me losing my teeth like my dad and all my cousins and all my uncles. So she threw me in a swimming pool and figured she was getting double duty. It was making me tired and keeping me clean.
Okay.
So I was a all-American swimmer, as I said, and then switched over to water polo. You guys would call that your junior year of college, and started playing for Canada for the national team. I played your American team many, many times all over the world.
Yeah, that's that. Your mom sounds like a smart lady, because there's a to be a dentist in hockey was probably a good job, I would imagine. Or I'm sorry, dentist in Canada rather.
Yeah, I don't think that too many of them bothered replacing their teeth. It was kind of a badge of honor when I grew up. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know that the dentist did any better either.
That's the fair point, yeah. And then at some point after, what happened when you got out of college? Did you immediately get into the outdoor stuff? I mean, I assume that was part of your upbringing as well, based on where you're from.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a trailer park. So if my dad didn't get a moose every year, we didn't eat meat. I couldn't go buy a cow. I didn't even know you could buy a cow. So we ate macaroni if Dad didn't get a moose. So definitely the field-to-table lifestyle was part of my upbringing, and as it was for many people back in those days. But I, you know, for me, there's always been a spiritual relationship with the outdoors. I didn't get into it professionally until after I had established my, you know, enough money that I could do it at a level I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So I had went into art, antiques, you know, ethnocentric art forms, and had three stores in Vancouver, one on Vancouver Island. Then Ralph Lauren bought most of my inventory out, and that's when I said, okay, it's time to make the leap to become a professional in the industry that I love, the outdoor industry.
That's interesting. So I'm not familiar. I know what the word ethnocentric means, but when you say ethnocentric art, what do you mean by that exactly? There's a lot of what you guys call First Nationers up there. So what was it exactly you were doing?
It's not Native American or First Nations. Mm. It's any ethnicity, any ethnic group that had a vernacular that they used and a traditional form of art that they followed, that's ethnocentric art. So masks, for instance, if you're going to use First Nations, African masks, you guys have... Really, I mean, it's not an ethnic group, but you have the Amish that made certain types of furniture, the Pennsylvania Deutsch, you know, they made a certain style. You also have the Hutterites that made a style, which we have in Canada as well. Yeah. So Dukhobor, Mennonite, Hutterite, Ukrainian, anything that they made that followed a traditional artistic form is ethnocentric, as opposed to idiosyncratic, which is an individual being an artist.
Sure.
Andy Warhol.
Yeah. You know, what made you decide to get into that? Is that what you studied in university, art history, something like that? Or was it, you just have...
No, my sister has a master's in art history, and she's American studies, or teaches down south. But, again, my novel, Call Me Hunter, that's, I believe you're born with an innate ability. Some people are with... To recognize beauty, and so I think it's just something that's inherent. you feel it. You feel beauty, and you know, not everybody has it. Some people have it on steroids.
Yeah, it is. I guess you know, it's funny you say that, because I can, if I look at art, I can tell if it's good or bad, but I can't tell you why. You know what I mean? I think a lot of people are like that. Like, you can, and it's, you know, I guess if you think about coloring in the lines to some degree, it's objective, but it is highly subjective as well. But I think that's the wrong way to look at it. Art's telling a story, right? So you're trying to read the story is the way I've always approached it. But I can barely sign my name legibly. I have no artistic talent in that regard at all. But I do enjoy it. You know, I wonder from your perspective, like when you look at art, whatever form it happens to come in, what is it that you're getting out of that?
Well, my museum, I'm sitting in our edit suite in our Hand of Man Museum of Natural History, Cultural Arts and Conservation. And so when I talk about art, when I look at art, the spirit of the person that made that work of art, whatever it is, and whether they made it for ceremonial purposes or religious, whether they made it just out of love, or whether it was just a calling that they had to create this art, their spirit is in that piece. Mm. And what you're picking up when you see it, that there's good and bad, is more than likely an instinct for recognizing truth. And when you recognize the truth of a piece of art, if it was truly made with the spirit of that person incorporated into that art, that's good art.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the person, that's the best they had. It's not Michelangelo necessarily, sure. but it could just be as simple as a walking stick that was a folk art walking stick. And the person's life is in that stick. That's maybe all that's left of them in this planet. And so when you see that art, if it's older, your contemporary art doesn't do a whole bunch for me personally, mm. because, you know, there's so much marketing involved. And so sure. It's hard to pick out the chaff from what's actually authentic.
Yeah, I don't think AI is ever going to be able to replicate something like what you're talking about, right? Like the grooves in the bottom of a walking stick that tell the story of where that person traveled. AI is never going to be able to do that. That's why I'm not terribly concerned about AI when it comes to the arts, because it'll always, like as you said, the wheat and chaff always separate.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they'll make great velvet paintings. You know, it'll probably be the best velvet paintings ever, mm-hmm. but it's never going to be great art, because how can it be when there's no soul?
Sure.
If that's missing from a work of art, then it's not a work of art.
One of the remarkable things about some of the older classic paintings is when they do these, you know, like radio scans of them and stuff, and you can see that there was something, not necessarily a different painting under it, but the process by which it was painted. Like there's some pretty famous works where you can see that a different general structure was laid down on the canvas prior, and then, you know, the painter came back and changed things here and there. That's like, you know, like to your point, that to me is what interests me about art, like that process, the story of the person, you know, that's actually doing it. Because who gives it, if it's just a painting on the wall, who gives a shit? It's aesthetic. It's fun to look at, I guess, but there's no depth.
Yeah, I mean, again, read my novel, Call Me Hunter. There's a fair bit in there about the art forging world. Mm. You know, including the Ghent altarpiece, the missing predella was, you know, the character in the book, Icarus, at that point, recognizes exactly what you're talking about, that the underlying base was real, that had the spirit of the artist in it, but not the piece that the person was passing off as real. It wasn't. The rest of it was overpainted. So again, it's Call Me Hunter, read the book. It's about exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I like that stuff. I mean, you know, even something as simple, if you want to call it simple, as like the stone tools that our ancestors used. There's a couple of hunting leases I go to in West Texas where you'll find things like certainly spearheads and arrowheads and things like that. But also knives that were used to sharpen things. And then you'll find little holes in the ground, right, where little holes in rocks in the ground where they were using them to basically grind up wheat into flour and stuff. I mean, it's that kind of stuff is really interesting. And when I got out of high school, I'm not particularly religious, but I went to seminary because I felt like studying religion was the best way to study history at the time. But I think, you know, things like geology and what you're talking about would probably have been a pretty nice parallel. I probably could have added some of that in there, to be honest, you know, because from my perspective, I wanted to understand how human beings had historically tried to understand their own existence in the universe, you know what I mean? And I felt like religion and philosophy were probably the best ways to do that. But there was a missing component that I didn't really understand until I got out into the real world and started seeing things that people actually crafted, you know what I mean? Because it's one thing, a belief system is one thing, but then how you interpret and put that into action practically in your own life is a whole other thing.
Yeah, well, I'm sitting here in our Hand of Man Museum. I've traveled all over the world. I found Mongolian iron points from Genghis Khan's time, is probably from his army. I found the, you know, the matata that you're talking about, the holes in the ground or the holes in the rocks that they, with a mortise and pestle for grinding the grain. Yeah, I'm sitting right here within, in this museum, 17,000 square feet. There's probably 150,000 stone projectile points,
wow,
you know, that are napped and out of flint. And I mean, I spend more time around the world looking at the ground than I do looking around, which, by the way, I'm surprised you're a hunter. At a hunting lease. Are you actually hunting when you're there, or you're?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yep. So you leave the field, you live the field to table lifestyle.
Yeah. I try to. I mean, I buy so about, I would say 80% of my meat comes from various farms around the area that I, where people I know or a buddy of mine knows that he's friends with them, but I know the farms, and he delivers the meat to my house and goes in the deep freezer, and then I try to stack the other part with stuff that I don't really eat stuff out of bags or boxes if I can help it, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's eat from the table, not from the store shelf. You'll be a lot better, a lot healthier.
Yeah, it's pretty it's interesting. One of my employees has been staying with me for a couple of months, and he's eating real food for the first time in his life. And it's you know, I you can tell that it's that even his wife was like, "Hey, you look better. What happened? What are you doing?" It's like, oh, I'm just eating real food. You know, it's it kind of sucks that it's that simple and we still can't fucking figure it out, to be honest. Especially in America. You know, 38% of Americans are either diabetic or in pre-diabetes right now. The richest country in the history of the world, and we're just a bunch of fat dummies, you know?
But, I mean, there's probably some people are smart. They just have terrible eating habits. And they've never been exposed to anything. They've been marketed, and they don't have the ability to learn. No one's teaching it. You know, follow the money. You know, there's way more money in marketing, whatever, Frosted Flakes, than there is in teaching people to grow a garden and eat healthy. I mean, there's no money in that.
So we're
a economic driven society, especially here in North America, and obesity is the result of it. I mean, there's the real pandemic right there. You said it.
39%. Yeah, I mean, it's insane. Those numbers are insane. It's like a plurality at this point, not a majority yet, but we're going there. We're getting close.
Yeah, some areas it's a plurality. Mm. It depends on where you're driving through when you're finding a fast food restaurants. Four on each corner, you know it's coming.
Yeah.
Even, you know, and it's not everywhere. I mean, there's places and there's people that are, you know, guys like Cam Haines are really, you know, promulgating this field to table lifestyle, getting out there, be healthy. You know, your body is your temple, so don't fill it full of garbage. You know, and you only get one life. If you think you can, you know, redo it in the next life, you can't. So people have to have the desire, though.
Sure. Well, in the information, I mean, it's what Cam does, what Stephenella does, a couple other guys, I mean, even Rogan to some degree is popularized a lot of this stuff. You know, it's really important because for a number of reasons, you know, diet and health as a result of diet is a big deal. And it's something I talk about on this show and my other shows quite a bit, because it's, that's low hanging fruit, man. You get to like, there's a lot of stuff in life you don't get to choose, but you get to choose everything that goes in your body. You know what I mean? No, nobody can, they can try to force you, but nobody can literally force you unless it's violently, to do something like that. And we've, again, your point is right. I mean, it's just bad habits. Habits are easy to make and hard to break. And we've lost the connection in our lives between effort and outcome. You know what I mean? Like, it isn't, like you said, you grew up in a trailer park. So if your dad doesn't shoot a moose, you guys don't eat meat for a while. People don't experience that anymore. And, you know, maybe it's hard to teach somebody who can just walk to a shelf and pick something up that's not the right idea, you know, because a lot of the vast majority of human life up until the Industrial Revolution was primarily focused on making life easier, right? But there was a critical mass of making life easier at some point where it was a diminishing return. And I would say it's probably somewhere in the 1940s when food preservatives started to become popular. Things like high fructose corn syrup, BHA, BHT, things like that. But we've got no connection between effort and outcome anymore. If you tell somebody, you know, that they have to go outside and do something to get a certain outcome, they're like, oh, that's not fair. Like, what do you mean fair? What does that mean? What does it mean for something to be fair in nature? You know what I mean? It's bewildering to me, but you grew up that lifestyle. And I think there aren't many people left in North America who grew up in that lifestyle.
Well, you know, I'm older than you, so you're probably right from what I'm saying. But I don't know that it's, I don't think the preservatives, I think that's a indicator. It's urbanization that's caused it. And again, that speaks to your point about let's make things easier. Well, it's easier if we all live together in one big bunch. But as soon as you urbanize, which we've done for, I mean, really, since the 40s, 30s, you know, that process is what causes us to lose touch with your outcome and the work that it takes for a certain outcome. So they say, you know, we needed preservatives. And to be fair, there's 8 billion of us in this world. And we can't all live on out in the rural areas. We couldn't survive with those kind of numbers. So urbanization, I think, was a big factor in this and why we've lost touch with, you plow the land, you sow the land, you weed it and you harvest it, and then you eat it for the winter. I mean, there's what we did for, depending on your faith, thousands of years or tens of thousands of years if you're a scientist. So, you know, this last decade has just seen an extreme acceleration in that process of, like you say, comfort. And, you can't blame anybody. It just is what it is. But unfortunately, it's built on an upside down pyramid. You know, that's not a foundation. It's not sustainable. And you know, build a pyramid this way, it doesn't take much to tip that sucker over. So, you know, then we'll be back to, you know, rural living again. And you know, we're adaptive. We'll figure it out as humans. But right now, living in a city, I mean, that's it's ticking. Yeah. It's what time are you going to have to leave that and get back to the land? It's going to happen. Yeah. It has to happen.
Yeah, it's certainly going to happen at some point. There are some programs that I've worked with here in the States. Hunters for the Hungry is one of them, where, you know, people who are shooting animals maybe for sport, but they send them to processing facilities, and the processing facility finds, you know, needy families and gives them the meat. But that is not a scalable kind of situation, to your point about urbanization and things like that. And we do have, I don't know about Canada, but in the United States, in major cities, we have really bad food desert problems, which is, you know, I'm not sure what the specific definition is, but essentially it means that a person doesn't have ready access in a grocery store to high quality fruits, vegetables, and meats, and instead have better access to cheaper fast food bullshit, right? I mean, that's kind of how it goes here. This episode is brought to you by GhostBed.com/DrinkItBros. GhostBed, It's the best bed in the world. It's the most comfortable. Sheets, pillows, the whole thing. I've got them all, man. And, you know, they wanted to extend their best possible offer to Drinkin' Bros. They've been with us for a very long time. So this is the email they sent us. We want Drinkin' Bros to get the best offer, so I updated the code for 50% site-wide. That's 50% site-wide. Use the code Drinkin' Bros. Drinkin' Bros with no G. For 50% off site-wide, everything that you buy on this site is going to be 50% off. Again, they get the best pillows, sheets, mattresses. They get the mattress protector if you're sloppy and spill things and you don't want to jack up your mattress. They have pretty much everything you need. They've got weighted blankets now. They've got the adjustable base, which we really like. I've got one in my home. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Use the code drinkitbros for 50% off site-wide. And don't forget about their pay-as-you-go plan. If you're with approved credit, you're going to be able to pay this thing off over the course of 3 to 5 years for $25 to $35 a month. It's nothing. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros today and use the code drinkitbros for 50% off. This episode is also brought to you by Black Rifle Coffee. com, the best coffee in the world. As a matter of fact, they won both the gold and bronze medal at the Golden Bean Awards this year for their exclusive coffee club entries in the elite category. So the best coffee on earth literally was Circus Bear by Black Rifle, one of their ECS. So I recommend that you go sign up for the Black Rifle Coffee Club. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. And, you know, you get all the benefits for being in the coffee club. You get the free shipping. You get access to all the partner deals. You get access to the exclusive coffee club. You get access to any new products that come out before anybody else does. You know, it's a very large club that they have over there. And the coffees are premium. Every single one of them is good. You're going to get experience for you. You can do just the plain coffee club. And if you want your two bags of espresso or your two bags of silencer smooth or whatever it is you drink, you can get those two bags or one bag or whatever you want every month, or rather you can use the ECS, the exclusive coffee club, and get access to some of the most premium coffees on the planet and kind of learn what it is that you like. You know what I mean? So then you can order those premium coffees from Black Rifle as well. So, and we all know they got the best branding, the best merch, and they're buddies. You know, we're all friends here. We love Black Rifle. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, sign up for the coffee club, or buy something, do whatever you want. Use the code CITIZEN, you're going to get those points off. This episode is brought to you by firstform.com/citizen. Free shipping on all orders over $75 when you use the link. And you're not going to spend less than $75. I mean, they got the best products in the world, especially the OptiGreens. You know me, I don't eat vegetables because they're fucking pointless. So I supplement with OptiGreens 50 from First Form. It is precisely formulated green superfood powder meant for overall immune system support and digestive health. It's really good, aside from just getting the daily greens into your body that you need. And make sure, by the way, you're taking this with MCT, because you have to take anything like this with MCT. 80% of your immune system is located in your gut and your digestive tract, right? So healthy digestion is essential for overall health and wellness, not to mention that most of your serotonin, I think 96% of your serotonin or 94%, is made in your gut as well. So you're going to be in a better mood. You're going to feel better physically, and you're going to feel better mentally if you are taking these greens. OptiGreen 50 has 50 chosen ingredients, effectively dosed. It's not necessarily how many ingredients there are, though, but it's about the right amount of each. Taste and texture, not like no other product in the market. It's not gritty. It doesn't have a weird flavor. It's got sweet berry flavors, actually. 100% of the greens are all grown and manufactured inside the United States, and they are bioavailable. Now, they've got other products as well. They've got the Microfactor, which you see behind me on every show, and I take them every day. You know, you got essential fatty acids, CoQ10, you got all the stuff you need in one little packet for your daily vitamin pack. And you mix that, you make yourself OptiGreens 50 shake, and you take those pills with it, and you're going to improve your life precipitously. You're going to feel better, you're going to look better, so on and so forth. So go to firstform.com, that's 1STPHORM.com/citizen. Use the code, you're going to get free shipping on all orders over $50. Do you have any thoughts on how, without blowing up our entire system and returning to the land, it's even possible to satisfy the dietary needs in urban areas? with actual quality food, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, if you pack, 100,000 chickens into a egg factory, a chicken growing factory, you can't. It's not possible to have all those chickens free range. So, do I have any suggestions? Yeah, I mean, population, control the population, but it's not going to happen with urbanization. So it's yeah, like I say, I don't think that there's any solution. There may be short term fixes on it, and it's all wonderful. It's a nice talking points, but it's not going to happen. It's not possible. There's too many people, and you can't, send every, you can't let 100,000 chickens from that factory go out onto the land to eat grasshoppers and fresh grass and the things that make, wholesome chickens and chicken eggs, the dark orange yolks. That comes from them being free range. And if you're going to pack the chickens into that factory, you're going to get what you get. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm a fatalist in this, but there's a reason there's a food desert in those places, because there's too many people living in those spots, and you cannot provide for them like someone that lives out in a rural area that has their own garden and their own chicken coop and goes and gathers eggs every day and butchers their chickens at the end of the year and lets two or three of them have chicks. I mean, it's not realistic to think that there is a solution to that problem, to let everybody live a rural lifestyle but still live in the city.
Sure.
Can't be done.
What do you think about food? I'm sorry, permafrost as in urban areas. Are you familiar with this?
No, I'm not.
So permafrost. Are you familiar with a permafrost, generally speaking?
I'm from Canada. I'm familiar with permafrost.
Yeah, right. It's I complained about the heat in Texas, but people don't die from heat as nearly as much as they die from cold, so I have nothing to really complain about. But a permafrost is, this is reductive, but essentially you have a hedgerow of different types of berries in a that is outlining, let's say, 1 acre of property. And then you have a specific set of trees and then plants planted inside of it. And it is a it's a forest that requires no attending to because of the design where the leaves and fruit fall off trees, refertilize soil, blah blah blah, right? I know somebody actually in Northeast Texas, which is shitty farmland, who's operating like a 3 acre one pretty successfully. Which is interesting because if you can do it there, I feel like you can probably do it most places. But I don't, again, something like that, there's no money in it. It's a community that's going to come and do that. And so you're probably not going to read about it. You're not going to hear about it on the news for sure because, every word they speak on the news has been paid for by someone. And I don't think communities are going to start taking out ads in the news anytime soon.
No, well, bad news sells for $2 and good news sells for $1. So what do you think is going to get and make it into the press? And I mean, permafrost, I think that's a cute name. I think it's a sweet idea. And when we all live back in Eden again, it'll probably work. But I mean, what's stopping the permafrost, the berries? Okay, well, what about the insects that eat them? How are you going to control that? The reality is the ecosystem you're creating is not a real ecosystem. It's a false ecosystem, and unless you throw in additives like insecticides and pesticides, herbicides, the little garden is never going to produce enough to, or the permafrost is never going to produce enough to sustain how many people for the amount of land. I mean, I think it's cute. It's a cute idea. And at least people are doing something,
Sure, yeah.
right?
Yeah. I
But I mean,
mean, trial and error, right? I mean, it's he he's it's working well for him, and in theory, it's In theory, it'll produce, after 3 years of growth, it'll produce enough food per acre, 30 people's worth of fruits and vegetables per year, basically, is the general calculation. But that's still, like, I don't know what a typical acre of farmland produces. I don't know in relation to, like, if let's say you have a rotational corn, sorghum, soy, whatever the fuck, I don't know what people grow down here. That's pretty much what people grow down here. But if you had a rotational acre like that, can it still do 30, or would it be way more? Like, I don't know how efficient it is, but it is. This is a solution for you and your small community, but it's certainly not a solution, or potentially it's a solution for that, but it's not a solution for like mass hunger or anything like that. You know what I mean? It's, I know it does sound fatalist, but I think you're right. I don't think this is, I don't think good food is sustainable like that. You know what I mean? It just doesn't seem likely.
Well, 30 people on 1 acre, I would give 26 of them high odds of dying of starvation. And that's 1 acre will produce enough for one family in realistic terms. And no one's going to use a bunch of 1 acre land for sorghum and to plant wheat to grind it. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Who 30 people, who's going to do the labor? I mean, you're going to, 30 people have to be working full time to do that. I lived with my wife Louise for 4 years. My goal was to become 100% self-sufficient. And this is back in 88 through 92. And in the end, it was coming down to I was going to have to grow wheat to grind it, to make flour. And I just said, no, it's the amount of work that it takes. It's a full-time job for one person. And we had about an acre garden, orchard, vineyard. You know, this 2 weeks ago, I picked 617 pounds of apples. I've so far picked 300 and over 50 pounds of grapes. You know, I've harvested all our plums. The pears are, you know, great pear crop this year as well. But that 1 acre garden would sustain our family, you know, as long as we had chickens as well, and as long as I hunted and I fished. You know, that was the only way to do it. And when you add in the hunting and the fishing, well, you're going to have to travel somewhere. Now, we have deer on our land, but, you know, you're allowed one. You know, wildlife conservation laws say you're allowed one. Well, that's not enough to sustain a family. So I think I think it's great marketing. Who's ever coming up with the idea, I think it's great. And I think it's wonderful because at least it's positive, moving people in a direction that is better than where we've been headed for all these years. And again, it's deurbanization. You want a 1 acre of land, go try and find it downtown New York City, downtown Los Angeles. Yeah. You know, it's not there.
Right.
But there's 8 million people around you living in where there's no 1 acres. So they're going to have to deurbanize if you want to have that working. I think it's nice. It's cute. It's not realistic.
No. I mean, not to solve all the problems we have, certainly. But I think it would be a good part of the deurbanization process. And it occurred, we've had these conversations on the show before. People think they need money. But in reality, what they need is what money can buy for them. Right. I mean, you don't, money's not a magical wand that you can wave and it makes all your problems go away. It represents your ability to get more of the things that you need, whatever they happen to be. If you can, you know, build, and this is a tough pill for a lot of people to swallow because they're so wrapped up in the modern culture and shit. They think that, I got to have the new pair of shoes. I got to have this. I got to have that, whatever it is. And we've just completely, in my opinion, we've lost our connection to our food, to nature, to what really matters in life. And life has become performative. It's like the ultimate iteration of keeping up with the Joneses at this point in Western civilization. And there's, you would think people, we've all read about this stuff. in history, and there's a pretty stark lesson about this type of behavior, this performative behavior, where we're all staring at the mirror at ourselves all the time. I don't know if folks have read the story of Narcissus. That's where the word comes from, right? This asshole stares into a reflection, stares into a pool of water, his own reflection, until he turns into flowers. You know what I mean? There's a lot more depth to the story. You should read it for yourself. But I mean, it's like, we've had people warning us against these types of behaviors for thousands of years now, and we still fall prey to them. I mean, I get it to some degree. Life is tough. Things go by fast. You're trying to make you're trying to make things better for your kids, maybe. But we never stopped to think about what better really meant. You know what I mean? We gave them more. We gave them safer, maybe. But what was it better? Because it doesn't seem like the results are any better, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between needs and wants has been blurred. Mm. And so people think they need this or need that, but they don't. They just want this or want that. When it comes down to it, needs are fairly primal. You need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clothing, you need some way to protect yourself from the other people that are trying to get what same thing that you need. So the base needs are we've totally lost touch with that, and we're mixing up a lot of times discomfort with a survival situation. We try and avoid discomfort. We also try and avoid self-determination, self-reliance, where we want to legislate all of that out of existence. Every possible thing that could go wrong, we want to legislate it out of existence. Well, like I say, 100,000 chickens in a big factory producing eggs, you better mitigate all the problems. The pathogens have to be dealt with. We can't afford to get sick, because one gets sick, the whole works get sick, because it's the pyramid. It's upside down. Mm. We're top heavy and all that. And I'm sure we've lost touch with it. I think it's why so many people feel emptiness inside them. Narcissistic personality disorder is I think, that's a result of this constant desire to avoid discomfort. Histrionic personality disorder, it's the same thing. Mm. The world's ending. We've lost, I mean, 100%. We're saying what the problem is, and we can talk till we're blue in the face about what the problem is, but who's coming up with a solution? Therein lies the person that comes up with that deserves a Nobel mm. Prize. Yeah. Find the solution to this. We can, like I say, talk till we're blue in the face, but there's 8 billion of us. So I don't know. What do you do?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think it helps that people like you, Cam, John Dudley, all the others we've mentioned so far, at least show an example of what it looks like to do these things. Uncharted was wildly successful. It's probably one of the more successful outdoor series of all time. The series of which is one in a series of other shows that you've done. I think that helps. I mean, one of the problems people have is they don't know what to do. People unfortunately have this someone's got to do something attitude, even when it's about their own lives sometimes. Like, oh, somebody's got to do something about this. Well, you better get up and fucking do something, dude, because nobody's coming to save you. You know what I mean? But it is nice, I think, because of that fact that people, that one of the primary barriers to entry to this stuff is people just don't know where to start or what to do. It is good that you have shows like yours that were on for, a long time. I think you were on for, 15 years maybe? I don't remember exactly. I've watched your shows before.
Yeah, over 20 years now.
Oh, over 20, Jesus. I mean, that's a lot of content showing people, hey, this isn't like, you don't have to be able to split the atom to do this stuff. This is what our ancestors did this before they even knew what an atom was. You know what I mean? You can get out there and do it, and it's going to improve your life dramatically if you do this stuff.
Yeah, the I think part of what you're talking about is people don't know what to dream nowadays. And also there's a lack of desire. You know, if I think it was Samuel Butler said that there's no limit to desire, but desire's need. And we people don't have the need to require the desire. You know, and again, Willa Cather said, desire is the magical element in creation. And if you could measure desire, you could predict achievement. Well, if you know, we talk about people not, you know, they don't know how to entry, don't know how to start. But the truth is they don't have the desire. It's really simple. It's really, really simple. You walk away from whatever you're doing and you go to a place where you can do what makes you whole, makes you fulfilled, makes you self-reliant. You know, this culturally perceived needs keep us, you know, like you say, chasing the Joneses. Well, we need two cars. We need a bigger TV. We have to go to this grand opening. If we don't attend this ballet, we're nobody. This charity event. Those are just wants. And people without the desire to leave that behind, to leave, embrace discomfort, embrace it. You know, who wants to leave the nice warm house to go out and sit on a freezing cold deer stand? Well, we're down in Texas, a super hot deer stand, you know, when they could be watching the football game on TV and swigging beers.
Sure.
I mean, that's easy. And human nature says, well, let's do that. And let's always choose the course of least resistance, which is that. Who wants to work hard? Who wants to, like I say, feel a discomfort? So I just think what we have in our society is a lack of desire. And whatever catalyst it's going to take to instill desire in people, it's not there at this point. You know, we're not at that tipping point where people, you know, you saw a little bit of it with COVID when people were locked in their, you know, 22nd floor suite in an apartment building in downtown, whatever, name a city. And they couldn't go out. They couldn't do anything. You know, suddenly you saw people, you know, rural land prices climbing through the roof as people were starting to flee the cities like a sinking ship. And so the, you know, you're going to see it. It'll happen. It's just the catalyst isn't there yet to cause that. You know, what they're not, there is no epiphany for them because they don't need it. They don't have the desire. They're comfortable where they are at this point.
Yeah.
So who knows what the catalyst will be, but it'll come. I mean, nature does that.
It'll come. That's right. I mean, at some point this will all return to nature. And we'll go, I mean, you know, life is like fashion. It's cyclical. Everything and every facet of civilization is cyclical, I think. And you've captured quite a bit of it. I think there's, you know, we look back to the past to, out of interest, I guess, but I think the best reason to look back is to learn lessons. And you tell me about the Hand of Man Museum that you've mentioned it a couple of times now, but it's a pretty massive spot and you've got a lot of stuff there. I mean, it's an impressive collection. I haven't been myself, but I've seen media on it before. It's a pretty sweet little situation there.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, it's an old school, 17,000 square feet on one level. So all the classrooms. I envisioned this museum when I was 10 years old. I started collecting for it, seashells, pretty rocks, insects, things that were free. As I said, we didn't have a lot of money. And I'd borrow fishing lures from my dad's tackle box. I mean, all those are in here. My grandfather's tackle box, those are the good ones. And I devoted my life to putting this museum together, to living a life that would allow this museum to become a reality. So it was a dream that, a goal, more like a dream than that I set, that I knew would be half a century. It would take a lifetime. So that's, this museum is a result of that. All the places I traveled, people assumed it was for the hunting. It wasn't, that was a tiny part of it. It was to A, experience life, and to share the cultures in those places, the cultural art and artifacts of those places with people that don't necessarily get to go to those places. Mm-hmm. So this museum is, it's the Hand of Man Museum of Natural History, Cultural Arts, and Conservation. So there's an education component as well. And the goal for me is, if people come in a little closed-minded, now some that come in, they're just ideologically opposed to everything that I would stand for, and you'll never reach those people. But many people just don't know. It's whatever they read in the popular press recently. So bad news, as we said, sells for $2. Good news sells for $1. So they're getting fed a bunch of, fluff. It's bad fluff. So, but they're still interested in learning. They're still interested in the truth. They just don't get a chance to see it with mainstream media. So when they come in, if they have their minds a little bit closed, my hope is with this museum, when they leave, they'll have found some tolerance. And it speaks again to the number of people in this world. There's 8 billion of us. We cannot hold our ideologies as being right and someone else's as being wrong. Right and wrong, we all know what is right and wrong. Every single one of us knows. Every single one of us. But often what we are thinking is right and wrong is just a cultural perspective, a social perspective, what our friends talk about, what they say. So this museum is meant to open people's minds and show them the past as well. Like you said, it's important to preserve the past so that we can learn from it. This period we're going through in our civilization, this has been done before. We'll look back on this, humans will look back on this as the Dark Ages, again, the time of Inquisition. And there's, I'm not going to bring up the other periods in our human history where, she's a witch, burn her. I'm not a witch. They turned me into this. And that's Monty Python, some of the wisest words ever said. And we're doing it again. You disagree with my ideology, so I hate you, and we will never, the twain shall meet. So this museum is meant to show that humans, the library in here, first edition books going back to 1508, Plinius, Sir Francis Bacon, 1679, these are all first edition books, Cuvier, Cobb, the natural historians, and Lewis and Clark's first edition, Alexander Mackenzie, the first one to go across North America. All these books are here, all the explorers. And it's interesting when you, I'm getting a little bit off topic, when you said you studied for seminary, that, back in the day, 500 years ago, we were all Renaissance people. We were all theologians, which is what you're looking for, theology. It's it's vitally important, but science is also important. We were all scientists. We were all artists. We were musicians. We were explorers. These are things that we were all one of. Then suddenly along the way, we started to divide up, and I go out here and I'm a scientist, so theology is bullcrap. You know, I'm an explorer, so you're just an academic. I'm out there doing the real operative. I'm a hunter. I break off exploration. You know, I'm an artist, and never the twain shall we meet on science side. Yeah, we've instead of embracing all of it, trying to learn the big picture, it's not dichotomized, but we certainly have separated from each other. And this museum is meant to bring everybody back together and show for hundreds of years, thousands of years, we have always been the same. We have always been the same. We want our children to be healthy. Mm-hmm. We want them to have food and water, shelter. We want to love. You know, there's some bad actors out there that always take advantage of human nature. And that's what's happening right now in our world. Like I say, we'll look back on this as the dark ages. We don't have any choice, but it's kind of for shame to use Charlie Brown's, you know, I think it was Linus said that, you know, for shame. But here we are. So this is my personal attempt to spend a lifetime to give people, to reintroduce them to tolerance. And my wife and I, Louise, we started the process 2 years ago to create a society to donate the land, the building, the contents. And, you know, I mean, it's tens of millions of dollars and give it an endowment to cover expenses for the next 40 years. So it'll always be donation. It's donation entrance now. Anybody, if you can afford it, great. If you can't, that's fine too. You can come in. I couldn't have come in with a $1 cover charge when I was young. So that is what this museum is. It's our gift back to I guess, the world. And hopefully, you know, because it's all private, it's all out of our own pocket. There's no government intervention. It'll never be changed. I'll have the board of directors handcuffed. So it can't be changed to fit into whatever wind is blowing socially at a given time and what is socially acceptable. It'll never be politically correct, which museums should not be. They should be about history, period. It can be about politics, but they should never be politicized. Our museum here in British Columbia, Royal BC Museum, Government Museum, I mean, just an outrageous amount of operating expenses every year. They're decolonizing it, decolonizing. So they're taking out an entire swipe of history that happened. Captain Cook's replica of his boat is gone. And we're not allowed to see that because somehow we're ashamed of it. No, we should never be ashamed. It's history. Learn from it. But again, you start me on my high horse on these kind of things. I'll talk your ear off. But the museum is, you know, was my wife's and my way of giving back for the next at least 40 years.
Sure.
And yeah, I'll continue that process till it's done.
I like that. That's the best reason I've heard for something like that. And now let's talk about Call Me Hunter. You said you've been working on it since you were 10 years old. Can you walk me through that?
Sure. Yeah. I knew at the age of 10, I was different. And I knew at the age of 10 that I would have this museum. I envisioned where I'd have to go. I had National Geographic. We could get that from the library. I'm going to go here. I'm going to see these people, going to gather these things. I want this mammoth skeleton in my museum, mammoth tusks. I want woolly rhino. I want art from around the world, mass cultural artifacts. So that was at 10. And it was, you know, I mean, it was a goal, but also a little bit of a dream. At the same time, I knew that ultimately in my life, I would be a novelist. And I was reading voraciously at that time. I started my first novel at that age. I wrote, by then we had a house. It was a little brick bungalow that every dinner conversation was whether we'd lose it because the mortgage, dad would get laid off, couldn't pay it off. But I started my first book then. I think I wrote about 10 pages, I don't know, 8 pages. And I hid it behind a brick in our planter at the house. But I realized right away that you can't just write a novel. You have to have, well, two ways. You can get educated to do that, become an academic, and then come out of university and sit down and write the great American novel. Or you can live life first and then write. And that's what I did. I picked it up again in 1993. I penned the first page, the first line. So Zhivago is dead. I hunted him down and I killed him. I wrote those lines in 1993. That's, you know, 30 years ago. And I realized even then, I got into it, you know, partway into the story, and I still hadn't lived life enough to have an interesting story to tell. To me, you know, what's interesting, and not to write my novel. So I continued living for another, 2019 October, Mozambique was my last international trip. And I determined that in 2016, because I was booked that far out. These expeditions take years to put in place into these wild places that I was going. And I sat down a month later when I got home, November 2019, and picked up those lines again. Zhivago is dead. I hunted him down and I killed him. I picked him up again, that first page, and started writing my story. And that's what it is. It's my story, right? COVID hit, and then Louise got ill. So, you know, but I had no intention of traveling anymore anyway. I've been there, done that. Mm. And if you don't put an end on something, you'll continue to do it. And it's a lot of fun to travel all over the world, have adventures, meet people. But I wouldn't be able to finish off this lifetime the way I wanted to finish it off when I envisioned when I was 10. So yeah, it's been decades. The process for this book has taken me decades. But again, I didn't go to school. I went to university, but my creative literature professor would always give me a C no matter what I wrote. So I actually copied a paper from someone who they gave an A to. This is a true story. This, in high school, I did that. It was Joni Mitchell. She went to my high school. So I copied one of her papers that she got an A from the same teacher and handed it in. You know, now this is probably 6-7 years after Joni Mitchell was there. And he gave me a C again. And this was the same all through university. So I'm not a big believer in academics. I think that life teaches you as much as what many of the teachers and professors can. So I live life first, and now I felt I was qualified to write a novel, and that's what I've done.
That's a really interesting perspective. Our buddy Jack Carr seems like he's one of my, as far as novels go, is one of my favorites. Him, Greg Hurwitz is another favorite. Speaking of Greg Hurwitz, I believe you guys share the same audiobook reader, Scott Brick. He's one of the best in the business.
I think so. I mean, he did the Clive Cussler books. Simon & Schuster had the new way to do audiobooks is almost like a play, like an old radio play where you have different people, voice people, playing the characters. Mm-hmm. And they had seven, they gave me 21 choices for, and I was supposed to choose seven of them. And I mean, I listened to them and these characters in the book. Now I'm 65. I've lived life. I've seen life. I've seen death. You know, I've been there and back again. And the voices, you know, the characters in my book, they have wisdom of ages, not, you know, they can't be, I don't want to denigrate anybody here, but the voices were just not, they were just not right. Mm. And so I felt I needed to read the second person perspective, which is never done in novels. There's Zhivago is dead, I hunted him down and I killed him. That second person perspective telling somebody else. And so I felt I had to read all those sections. And my first and only choice, I said, look, I don't want any of these 21 people. I want Scott Brick. Mm. And there's a reason I wanted him, because I feel, and you know, Jack, the fellow he uses is wonderful. I don't think it's Scott, it's someone else. And, you know, great, you know, the best of the best. But Scott, I don't know, I'm old school. I like his, he's anyone that did Clive Cussler is pretty cool in my books. So I said, no, not the seven. I want Scott Brick. And Simon & Schuster said, absolutely. And sure. Yeah. I haven't heard it yet, but I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Well, he's done. So Greg Hurwitz writes the No Airman series, or Orphan X series, however you want to refer to it. That's one that's really good. He did a bunch of Baldacci's books, Michael Crichton. He did Tom Clancy books. He did a lot of stuff. Yeah, so he's great. Well, look, I'm looking forward to reading this. I just bought it on Amazon now, and you can buy it too on Amazon. The official release date is the 17th of October, but it's available for pre-order now. This will come out Monday next week, so it'll be the day prior to release. So go out there and buy the book. It looks like it's going to be really interesting. I can't wait. I listen to everything, so I'll get it on Audible and listen to Scott's voice for a while.
Yeah. I was going to say, how can you not have a advanced reader copy sent to you? And it's, but yeah, audiobooks, you know, they've surpassed hardcover book sales now. I mean, we spend so much time in worlds where audiobooks are the only thing we can do. We can multitask and listen to a story. Mm-hmm. So yeah, audiobooks are definitely on the rise, and especially people that live our lifestyle. You know, we have lots of time where you're traveling, doing whatever, sitting on stand, you can listen to a book, mm-hmm. As opposed to reading, because we do need to multitask nowadays to accomplish just getting through each day and our responsibilities.
Yeah, I like it though. I mean, I enjoy reading as well from books, but this has definitely been one of those technologies that's been a value add, I think, for my ability to take in more and more stuff, especially serialized things like Jack's got what, 6 books now. Greg's on his 10th, I think, in that series that'll be out in February. So I really enjoy that, and I really enjoyed this conversation. You're a fascinating person. I like the way that you've lived your life very intentionally. It's something that I try to do myself. And then, you know, it seems like a lot of your focus tends to, try to grab up as much information as you can and put it out to people so they can make their lives better, which I appreciate as well. So I thank you for coming today. Everybody go check out the book, Call Me Hunter. It's sure to be great. And again, thank you for coming today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, sir. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.